whether the NBER actually declares a recession or not nationwide doesn't mean that the economy is not already in a recessionary-like environment. It just hasn't been all numbers.
Hello and welcome to Pillars of Wealth Creation, where we talk about creating financial success with a special focus on business and real estate. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. Now, let's get to it.
Hello and welcome back to Pillars of Wealth Creation. I'm your host, Todd Dexheimer. With me, excited to have Anna Kelly. Anna, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. It's so good to be back with you. It's been, I think, maybe 2 years since we last did a show together.
I think it's been longer. So listeners, go back to episode 234 and listen to Anna Kelly. She just a wealth of knowledge. And we're going to talk a little bit different today. So you'll want to go back to that episode. Check out what she talked about then. And I really wanted you back on. You came to Minnesota. That's probably been a couple of years, right? You came to Minnesota a couple of years ago. You were part of the North Star Real Estate Conference. So really appreciate you being there. And, you know, I always see your social media posts and your wealth of knowledge. You post a lot about what's going on in the economy. You're just a lot of knowledge behind your posts and very detailed. So I always love them and I look forward to your posts. You, by the way, you haven't made one in a while. I'm looking for it. I need to see one. So I want to know what's going on inside your brain. That's really one of the biggest reasons why I wanted to bring you on, but also you're just an awesome person. So I want to bring you on for that. So a little bit about,
thank you.
a little bit about Anna, and then again, you can just tell us anything I'm missing, but is the president at Greater Purpose Capital, REI Mom LLC, and she's a former top-rated financial relationship manager for a private bank, worked at AIG for 20 years in the high net worth and affluent markets group, focused on creating hedge fund, wrapped insurance investments. She's also been in real estate for 25 years. So just a ton, like I said, just a ton of knowledge. She's been around the finance industry, real estate industry for a long time, and actively has owned and managed a rental portfolio valued over $400 million across several states. And so I guess really with that said, anything else you want our listeners to know about your background?
Great. Thank you so much. First of all, thanks for having me back. And it was a pleasure to be at your conference. And yeah, you know, I haven't posted a lot about the economy. I'm actually planning on posting something kind of long this week. We've been in about kind of more of the same over the last several months, just kind of waiting. Everybody's waiting to see, you know, what's going to happen with inflation numbers and GDP and are we or are we not going to have a hard landing? So I'll go there. But just, you know, I think the biggest thing about my background that has helped me as an investor to navigate where we are today and how I'm looking at my portfolio and challenges and opportunities, you know, coming up in the future is that I didn't start out in real estate. I started out, as you mentioned, in private banking. And so, you know, I grew up way back, you know, I grew up in Section 8 housing. My mom was a leasing officer and then an apartment manager. So I grew up in apartments and I really didn't have anybody in my family who knew anything about finances. We were not wealthy, far from that. But where I really learned the most, aside from just, you know, getting my degree, was in my financial advisory training at Bank of America, when they started their private banking department back in 1997 or 1998, is when I was there. And so I learned to think as an investor before I learned to think as a real estate investor. So while I'm constantly thinking about, you know, real estate and multifamily in particular, and I invest in, you know, short-term rentals and small apartments and single-family homes and all of that, is I really learned that you've got to kind of look at risk premium. So you start with, you know, what's the risk-free rate of return, which has always kind of been that 10-year treasury. And then anything else you're ever going to invest in, you say, well, what is the potential reward or return? And then what kind of risk do I have to take to get there? And then, you know, what's happening in the economy that can bring us different risks that we're not thinking about to make it even more risky than we think? And then we say, okay, given the risk that's there, am I willing to invest, you know, for the potential return? And so what I learned, even though I had a really good foundation was two kind of things. One was that if you had a lot of money, I could tell you what to do with it, at least as well as I had been trained. And I always worked with ultra affluent, the top 10% of the wealth in the bank. When I was at AIG, we created, you know, private placement investments within an insurance policy so that you could make 20, 30, 40% returns tax-free in insurance for estate planning. But I realized that myself, I had no money. And for me to grow wealth, it was going to take me 40 years of investing, you know, small amounts of money that had to really accumulate a lot over time. But I didn't have a lot to start with. So it was going to take me years. And so I got into real estate, Todd, bought my first property in 1998 because a wealthy client to me laughed when we told him we could make him 8% CDs. Like today we were hoping for 5, right? And he just said, honey, I make more than that in my real estate investments. And it was this aha moment that wealthy people had real estate. I learned nothing about real estate in all of my training and in my work there at Bank of America. And I learned I need to at least start thinking about acquiring assets. So I bought my first condo and it kind of went from there. So the whole time that I worked at Bank of America and AIG, as I was helping wealthy people create products to grow their wealth, I was thinking, how can I create chunks of cash that I can then use to invest? And so I thought I was doing pretty well. Then the crash of 2008 happened and I was blindsided. I realized that I knew a lot. I was starting to learn a lot about real estate. I knew a whole lot about investing, but I really didn't know nearly as much about the economy and economic cycles and how Fed policy and interest rates could impact investing. So when I almost lost everything in 2008, I had a small business. We had a ton of debt. We were told in 07, the economy is booming and it's only going to get better. Go into debt, start a business, rates are low, right? And suddenly, it seemed like, and suddenly, everybody said it's different this time. And suddenly, we had the great financial crisis. I worked for AIG. My 401k was almost completely wiped out in a week's time because I was heavy into financial stocks and companies that never came back. I was losing my job. And I realized the only thing that was going well, Todd, was that my tenants were still paying rent. And at that time, I had about 12 units. And I thought, if I'm going to lose my job, I've got to get more apartment buildings because tenants are still paying rent. And yeah. I found out the week of the GFC that I was pregnant with baby number 3. And it seemed like the worst possible week ever. I mean, yeah. I was happy to be having a baby, but I thought, how am I going to support this kid? Gosh. We have a small business, $700,000 in business startup debt, like serious, right? And I realized the power in the GFC that I can be smart. I can be good at what I do. I can know investments. I can know real estate. But if I don't understand what happened and how the economy outside of my control affects my investments and watch for it, I'm vulnerable to the same thing happening again. Yeah. But it was the aha moment that I have to take my economy into my own hands. And that's when I really started heavily, seriously investing in real estate, was in the throes of the great financial crisis, because I knew I had to take control of my money and I had to learn the economy. So the reason I post so much about the economy all the time is, one, I want to save people from making the mistakes that I did pre-GFC, thinking the economy's great. The news says it's different this time. It's a soft landing, and making poor decisions leading up to it. And when there's a bottom, I want to be able to take opportunity of that. So if I can help people do that through my own experiences, just in the investment world and my corporate career, and then how I've created wealth since the GFC, then that's really what it's all about to me, is impacting and helping other people.
Yeah, it's, and I really appreciate you doing that. I think that's so powerful, valuable. I think one of the beautiful things about, you know, maybe social media and our communications now is there is so much more knowledge out there and easier to find. However, sometimes that creates more distraction and confusion because there is so much out there. There's a lot of opinion. So you have sift through it. So that's certainly a negative, is you have to really sift through and understand who are the experts, who are the talkers, you know, what's really happening.
Right. There is selling you stuff.
Yeah. Who's selling you stuff. Right. But there is a lot of knowledge out there right now. And if you if you can find the right people to kind of attach to and say, okay, what are they thinking? I think you can get a lot of really good advice. Man, I can just read. I was not in real estate prior to 2008. And I wanted to be. I just didn't know how. I didn't have money. And I was young at that time, younger, too young to really have anything established to be able to. So I got lucky, right? If I been 5 years older, I probably would have, purchased some properties and maybe lost everything. Who knows? I don't know. But I do remember listening to people and hearing people talk about the economy and how it's just roaring and it'll never stop. And I remember listening to somebody say, well, they're not making any more land, right? Yeah. They don't make any more real estate. You got to get it now. And it's just going to keep on going up. If you see something for $250,000 right now, it's going to be $450,000 in a couple of years. You got to buy it. And right. I thought, well, that's good advice. I better go buy some stuff. And we did buy our first single family house that we luckily sold like right before the bottoms fell out. Like that we were living in the house and we moved from one town to another. So we couldn't keep the house. We sold it. And literally, I swear on it, like a day later, like the bottom fell out. And we just got lucky and ended up buying a foreclosure for our next house. But anyways, that's my a little rant. But I think it's so interesting how people's minds work in that everybody says now everybody's like, oh, well, duh, you should have seen that coming. Like how right. did people make that mistake? You should have seen it coming, but it feels like nobody saw it coming. Everybody right. was just over exuberant. And that's what continues to happen in recession after recession. Nobody, I feel like we're in this weird time right now, but what happened with commercial real estate or happening with commercial real estate, I feel like nobody saw it coming. They maybe should have. What is your thought? Like, I want to know, because I want to be talking about what's going on. Sure. Are we seeing a recession? Are we going to be seeing a recession? There's been a lot of talks about it. What's your thought on it? Are we going to see a soft landing? Like, where are we at right now in this economic cycle? And where do you feel like we're heading? That's a big question. So we can kind of sift
them out. Sure. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because after 2009, I decided I've got to become a student of the economy because I worked at AIG. I also was in the same division as the company that did credit default swaps, and I didn't understand them, right? And so it's like, oh, I've heard of these things, but they minimize the level of risk that was actually inherent in credit default swaps because they never thought it could really happen that multiple companies would fail at once. Yeah. And that is what happened. Yeah. And it happened because they were all investing in and hedging in mortgage-backed securities, right? Which was a thing to own that seemed at the time safe, right? Mortgage-backed securities had always been one of the safest things to invest in outside of U.S. treasuries for a little risk and a little reward was the thought. And so it was underestimating the systemic risk inherent in all of real estate and how things were packaged and hedging that I think really took so many people by surprise. And yes, there was some fraud and yes, there's greed. I mean, let's face it. People are looking back now on commercial real estate investors and saying it was all fraudulent, greedy investors. And no, it hasn't all been fraudulent, greedy right. investors. Sure, there's some of that, but you have to realize that the U.S. economy as a capitalist society is based upon creating value and generating reward. And there's always risk involved in that. And so for every investment, it's how much risk are you willing to take? And the higher the returns, the higher the inherent risk. And we all know that to some extent. But what I think is underestimated is similar to today. It's those exogenous factors outside of what we look at day to day that we don't realize is like risk starting to boil to the surface. So for example, you look back at 2007 and now if you go back, you'll see articles that were written in 2004, 5, 6, 7 that were warning, we're in a real estate bubble. Some of these there's too many subprime mortgages. Like there was a lot of people warning. I shouldn't say a lot. There were a few people, a handful of economists warning, but it was like a buried headline, a small article on finance in one, but you know,
a little 90%. Whisper among the yelling, right?
Exactly. But if you look at it, I mean, all the top banks and financial companies, insurance company, they were all investing in.
These are the smartest people in the room, right?
Absolutely. And that was the thing that I thought, how did I miss it? Because I made some bad personal financial decisions in hindsight that if I had made them 2 years before, I would have looked like a rock star, right? Yeah. But I did it at the same time that everybody thought it's different this time and it's going to keep on going. And so I see those same themes repeated over the last couple of years where, you know, COVID, I sold some property really early. So I will say this, my crystal ball is broken. I think I have a good thesis of where we are and where we're going, but my timeline has been proven wrong. And everything's taken longer than I thought it would to happen. And part of that, what I've learned is that the economy is significantly more intertwined and complex than I ever understood before, even working in that realm. And today it's more so sufficiently complex and intertwined than it was even in 2008. So, you know, you think about derivatives, for example. So, you know, I take a loan from you and I have my apartment building as collateral. Well, now you're a bank and you want to use your loan that's an asset on your books as collateral for a loan you want to take. So you put my loan as collateral for a loan that you take as a bank. Well, then that bank goes and needs a loan and uses the loan they sent to you. So a derivative is when the same asset has multiple loans collateralizing the same underlying assets. The derivatives market today is somewhere between $1 quadrillion and $4 quadrillion. Dollars. So what it tells me, just that alone, and I know we're talking real estate, but when you have an asset value that's at risk of falling and there's multiple contracts on that, it's not just that interest rates make your commercial real estate property technically go down in value because your cap rate's changing, right? Because now you need a risk premium to buy your apartment building that's above the 4% US Treasury or no one's going to buy it. So you got to sell it at a 6 cap, 7 cap, 8 cap, whatever that is. But the value of your property goes down. The value of that asset on the bank's book goes down. But then there might be 4 or 5 other loans on that same collateral. And so it's this domino effect. And that's just a tiny bit of what I'm talking about. But you've got international companies were impacted by the war between Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. We were impacted in that, you know, impacts oil and shipping and supply of food, of grain, microchips. You've got now China threatening to go after Taiwan, budding at Russia. Now you've got war, you know, Israel against Hamas, war funding, you know, a lot of those things. And that's all post-COVID and all the supply chain risks. So I feel like in the last 3 years, we've shown the vulnerabilities of our interconnected global system, our U.S. financial system and interconnected. And I quite frankly think it's more complicated than anybody can wrap their head around, including the Fed. And therefore, when we anticipated risk coming in post-COVID, we thought, I could see, hey, rates are low. They dropped them because of COVID. This could be a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy a bunch of assets, lock in low rate debt. It's opportunity. And I saw that. And I understand there's systemic risk created by COVID. But I think I underestimated, well, what if a war happens too? And what if another war happens too? And then inflation gets bad. And then energy prices go up because of, you know, the wars. And then because of that, my interest rates skyrocket 5 years from now when I need a refi. I wasn't thinking like that, Todd. I was thinking these rates won't stay low forever. I'm not doing bridge debt because I saw people learn the lesson of that in 08. If I do anything variable, it's going to have a rate cap so that if rates come up because of inflation, which we could all see was going to happen with all the helicopter money, if we were studying history, I thought, there's going to be inflation. And then after that, there's going to be a recession because you can't come out of COVID and not have a recession. You can't come out of high inflation and not have a recession. So I learned to look for those things and I anticipated them, but I still made some decisions that I could not have in, you know, hindsight, I go, well, duh, all these things could have happened. But I didn't think that the probability of anything getting worse, like all these wars, was very high that I had to worry about it. And we can see that the impact of all these things outside of the United States and outside of the real estate market are really one domino after another that are making buying properties at low interest rates, at low cap rates, thinking we were going to have a blip where maybe it got bad and then it was all going to go right back to normal. That was short-sighted, and it didn't understand the complexity of the kind of things that could impact rates and values. So I hope that answers your question a little bit, but, you know, I can anticipate things, but you can't anticipate everything. And that's just part of life, is that you learn that if I'm going to take risk, I better know how to mitigate everything within my control. And then I got to think about, like, what's the worst thing that could happen? Because the worst thing that could happen could be worse. And then make a decision. Do I have enough skills and network and experience that I'm willing to take the risk thinking I can mitigate most of it? And can I then make a good return to reward me for that risk? And so, you know, that's the same as it's always been. But I think we're in clearly a globally challenging economic market that nobody can say they really saw coming. We could, you know, hopefully made some good investment decisions mitigating some of those risks. But I think that the risks are still quite pronounced, and that the economy can get a lot worse before it gets better.
Yeah, that's, I think you said so much there, but I think you have to understand the risks. Like you said, you have to be aware of what can happen. I mean, you can't let that just completely stop you from, you have to say, okay, there are these risks that are available, and I'm going to take these steps to mitigate against those risks and say, yes, is my risk reward worth it? And if you say, yes, my risk reward is worth it, then we have to push forward knowing that certainly could you lose that investment. If everything goes wrong, that could go wrong. Yeah, you're probably going to lose the investment, but you've hedged against enough things to say, look, I'm pretty okay. Like, there's a lot of things that have to go wrong for it to go wrong.
Right. And this is why diversification is so important, Todd. Yeah. And that's another thing where a lot of real estate investors, you know, when a sector is hot, a sector of the economy or real estate, everybody wants to be in that sector, right? So whether it's tech or oil or AI or real estate or Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
It's like, this is the new thing. It's going to skyrocket in value, and then the party's going to stop. And then you could lose a bunch of money depending on timing. And so I learned, and I'm thankful that I learned this lesson back in my days at Bank of America, never to put all my eggs in one basket. So, you know, for my friends, and I say this lovingly because I feel terrible for them, but I have a bunch of friends in multifamily, because that's the space that I've been primarily in the last several years, that said, I'm going to sell every property I own and I'm going to go all in big multifamily. And if we had personal conversations, I said, don't do that, because if anything ever happens with big multifamily, or rates go back up or values fall, that's all you've got, but you don't own anything yourself. So I always kept small properties of my own, so that if something happened with commercial real estate, which is valued very differently than residential, my residential would be okay, right? Or you're in some stocks, or you're holding gold. But you should never go all in any one asset class at any one time, because there's always risks that we can't see. So, you know, that will save people a lot of headache if they were somewhat well diversified. And I hope that, you know, if anything, this teaches people, like, diversification is really important.
Yeah. And I love the idea. I get the, I'm going to sell everything and just focus on, you know, multifamily, focus on whatever that is. I love that idea, burn the boats and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And we're going to focus on it. But I still think, like, look, you can still be all in on, you know, call it multifamily, and still own some of the single families that you used to own. It doesn't mean you're not all in, like,
right.
So
because there's a difference in what you do and what you're operating. and what you own and invest in.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of people mixed that up over the last few years and just said, okay, I'm only going to do storage or big apartments or Bitcoin or whatever. Your main thing should be your main thing in business.
Yes.
Cycles can change how that main thing is done and whether you want to add other things to it.
Agreed.
But I just, because I was so burned pre-08, I learned that lesson that I will always have enough of my own properties, bringing enough passive income that if I never did another deal in my life, for whatever reason, I would be able to have my means met. And so I think that that's something important for everybody, regardless of where the economy goes, because we haven't even thought yet about what's coming next. But, you know, have enough passive income or, you know, streams or assets that really allow you to live without ever having to work another day or do another deal. And you'll be able to weather these kind of storms if and when they happen.
I'm so glad you said that, because you just made me feel really smart, because sometimes I question my decisions, because I have a lot of friends in the real estate industry that sold everything and did exactly what you said. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I'm going to keep some of these, my best performing properties. I'm going to keep these top 25 best performing properties. And if stuff goes wrong, I've got those and always have those. And I'm just going to let
And that's so smart, Todd.
Well, I thought I was stupid at times. Sexy. Right.
Right. Right. Because everybody else is telling you something different. Right. But here's the challenge. And you know, I coach students and, you know, of all kinds of different real estate persuasions. But I had a student about 2 years ago, and they're doing really well as syndicators. And they're primarily fund managers. So they raise money for other people's deals primarily. But they wanted to kind of, you know, burn the ships as well and get rid of everything. And I said, okay, if you can't find deals, because a couple of years ago it was bidding wars, you know, you offer on 20 and you might get highest and best on two or three. And then, you know, it sells for some crazy amount by someone paying cash and, you know, you get outbid. So that's kind of where we were a couple of years ago. But I said, if you are hiring an acquisitions manager and an underwriter, and, you know, there's three others of you and you've got a staff now of six people because you want to scale, but you're already having a problem getting deals done. How are you going to pay yourself and all these people if you're not constantly doing deals and getting big acquisition fees, which are getting smaller and smaller? So I said, don't hire so fast, you know, do some of the work, hire maybe fewer people, buy some smaller properties that are longer term buy and hold so that you've got that income. And I know many syndicators, Todd, that are going back to full-time jobs because they can't they can't find deals that pencil, and they have to lay off their staff because they depend on that next deal and that next deal and that next deal. So I started kind of seeing that writing on the wall, and I started slowing down what I was buying and saying, I'm only going to do amazing deals. And if it's not an amazing deal, to me, there was too much risk in the last year and a half, especially by a year and a half from out, we should have all known, like, there's pain, right? Even 2 years before, it's like, if it's not a smoking deal, like a, you know, heck yes, then I'm going to let it go. But the only reason that I sleep really well today, Todd, and again, I've got some deals that have challenges. So this isn't to say I've done it all right, because I've still made mistakes because I never could have seen what's happened over the last 3 years, especially post pandemic. But I sleep well at night because I have a few hundred units that I own myself or with a couple partners that are long-term holds that bring in money every single month, so that I know I don't have to chase deals to keep people employed. I don't have to chase deals to get big asset acquisition fees so that I, you know, can take care of my family. I just don't do a great deal unless I know I have what it takes to mitigate the risk and explain, and, you know, the risk to my investors, and that they know what they're getting into. So I've done I've only done two large deals in the last year and 2 months, large multifamily deals, where before I was doing, you know, several a year. So I really slowed down, but it was having that own portfolio of my own that allowed me to do that without any stress of impacting other people that I coun't pay, for example, if I didn't get the acquisition fee.
Well, and it's a nice thing to be able to talk to your investors about that too. Is one of the things that I've liked about keeping my portfolio is I can tell investors because I would get that question, you know, how many deals are you doing a year? And it's like, well, look, our goal is to do 4, maybe 5, maybe 6 deals a year, but we don't have to do any deals.
Right.
And so we are going to pick the best deals to do and focus on those. And we're going to pass on the deals that we don't think are the greatest. So we're only looking for the best deals out there, and we don't have to do, we're not forced to do deals. And that's a better position to be in than that company that has to do deals just to put food on the table, just to pay for the employees. You just have to get a deal done. So you might do a deal that you're just compromising on. You're like, well, we got to get this deal done.
Unfortunately, that's been the case a lot for the last couple of years because of the bidding wars leading into then it's high rates and high prices. And there's no real way to make it work without risk, especially when the capital markets have dried up or really lowered their LTVs.
So rates are really high right now. We went from basically zero, right? And if you look at the 10-year treasury, I think right now we're bouncing around the low fours. So rates have gone up really drastically. We were into the fives, right? There's a lot of real estate that has loans coming due in 2024, in 2025. And so there's this, what are we going to see? Like, are we going to see a blood on the streets? Or are rates going to come down and rescue people by the Fed dropping rates to a level where people can now refinance? What is your kind of crystal ball or thought process through what are we going to see here in commercial real estate? And maybe how are you preparing right now?
Okay, great question. One, I've become much more humble as I've gotten older and gone through things and made mistakes, or my crystal ball didn't come, on my timeline. So I will say this, I listen to the economists that I listen to, Todd, are much older than I am. You know, I'm 49. I feel young, although I know that puts me right about at middle age, but I listen to economists and billionaire hedge fund managers, billionaire REIT managers that are in their 70s and their 80s, and they've lived through the 70s and 80s crisis when I was just a kid and before then. And there's there's disparity between what they think as well. But I will say this, most of them say we are heading in for harder times. The soft landing is not cooked in. The recession is not called off. Asset values have not stopped falling. The banking crisis is not averted. And get ready, recession is coming, and it's going to come, and it's going to be worse than most people think. So based upon, just studying the Fed and how they react and looking at the details of the financial numbers, I think we're heading into a recession. I would not be shocked. I would bet, but not a whole lot of money because my timing's been off quite a bit. I thought for sure we'd be in a deep recession by last summer, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
And the numbers, though, if you look at the inverted yield curve, which is the most accurate prediction of a recession, it's been inverted almost for 2 years, like 80 weeks. It's been inverted 80 to 82 weeks, pretty much consistently indicating a recession. Usually once it inverts, you've got about 6 months and you're in a recession. Okay. So that's one thing. If you look at the U.S. leading economic indicators that the National Bureau of Economic Research uses to date recessions, 9 out of 10 of them are in recessionary territory and have been for a year. The only thing that's kept the economy propped up has been GDP and jobs. So GDP, though, if you look at the details of the numbers and you look at the job numbers, which I know we don't have a ton of time, but I'll go into here just for a second. At a national level, they look a lot higher. The data is, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the reality is the data is manipulated. Yep. There's lag effects. And the way that it's reported is always, almost always, adjusted downward, more negative after the headline comes out of what the number is. So you've seen recessionary territory for most of the economy, just not for the Magnificent Seven of the stock market. And it's been almost like this rolling recession. So manufacturing's been in recession. Industrial is now in a recession. The auto market has been in a recession. Real estate has been in a recession. But GDP has been 3.7%, right? Or unemployment's been 3.7% and GDP's been positive. But all those things tell us we should have been in a recession. And in fact, we've had two negative quarters of GDP, but a recession wasn't declared because we had low unemployment, higher than normal employment and GDP, when we had negative GDP. So whether the NBER actually declares a recession or not nationwide doesn't mean that the economy is not already in a recessionary-like environment. It just hasn't been all numbers. But here's one thing I'm looking at. Gross domestic product and gross domestic income are two measures of the health of the economy. And Lacey Hunt is someone that I follow that I highly recommend you listen to. He just did a panel last week. He's an older economist, and he talks a lot about GDI, but GDP is what we're looking at. And basically, gross domestic product is the accumulation of sales. What if people bought, okay? GDI is gross domestic income. It's the combination of all private companies' earnings and government earnings and personal earnings and income. And if you look at GDP and GDI, they're supposed to be almost identical because income is spent and spent comes back in income. So they stay pretty close. GDP was at 3.1%. GDI was at -1%. Wow. It's a 4% gap, and it's the largest gap that there has ever been. Mm. And any time that there's been a gap, I think it's of more than 1%, we've had an immediate recession. So the fact that incomes are reporting at -1%, even though this lagging GDP is higher, tells us the economy is really struggling. The other piece of that is if you look at the unemployment numbers, and this is just, I'll just say this at a high level, they've been positive. But if there's a study that's shown on recessions that anytime the government has more than 10% of the new job openings and the growth is in government jobs, we've headed right into a recession. In 2023, 25% of the new jobs created were government jobs. So it's 250 times more than when it put us in a recession. It means the private sector, Todd, is not hiring. So despite the Magnificent Seven being really great in stocks, if you look at the stock performance today, we've crossed this warning sign of recession where more stocks are negative than there are positive. It's just that the few are floating the rest. And it's kind of like that with employment. If you look at employment plus social service jobs, those that help people with, let's say, migrant help, rental assistance help, those types of social services, it's over 80% of the jobs created are in social sector and government spending. So all those things tell me
we're not building,
and that's just a few of the things, that the economy is not nearly as healthy as everyone says. And 88% of states that answered did their own payroll and employment surveys are saying that their employment numbers are much worse than what the unemployment's going up in 88% of states. So I think we're definitely heading toward a recession. I would bet money on it. The question is when. I think we're already in a recession. I really do. And I think that when the NBER finally dates recession, they never do it till 6 months after it's already started. I think they're going to go back to the very end of 2022. Or to now and say we are in a recession. The bad news is that means that families are going to struggle. As operators of multifamily, I'm going to have increased vacancies. People are going to move back in with families as they're laid off. They're not going to be able to pay their rent. That's the negative side. The good side for us, especially those that have loans renewing, is that once we hit a recession, the Fed will absolutely cut rates far more than what they have forecasted in their Fed meetings, because they have to. And that's part of why I think they've held them up so long, is they didn't want to go back to the zero bound easily and have a rally in the market and send everybody spend and make inflation come back up. They're like, let's wait till we have to. But the moment that they cut rates, Todd, that's going to mean that suddenly rates are at least a lot lower, so we can get better, we'll probably have more offers for our properties, and the Treasury risk-free rate of return goes back down. Let's say maybe it's not zero bound, but maybe it's 2%. Then, that cap rate for apartment buildings historically, as far back as they've been tracking cap rates, historically has been 230 basis points above the U.S. Treasury. So if a Treasury goes to 2, that tells me Class A cap rate should be back in the 4.3 range for a quality asset in a big city, a major market. And that's a whole lot better than where they are today. Right. So that could save our values, make values higher, and make it easier to refinance. The only thing I'm kind of nervous about for investors is that usually banks don't tighten credit and lower LTVs that they'll lend until after recession. We've been seeing them doing it for over a year now. So I think that you can borrow for cheaper when we hit a recession and it's declared. But I think that the LTV that banks lend on multifamily is still going to stay constrained, maybe 55, 60, 65%. That's going to slow transactions that otherwise would just be crazy. But it's hopeful for multifamily asset prices when rates come back down, despite the fact that you're going to be in a recession. Our cap rate's going to be better, but then the NOI may struggle a little bit because of tenants not being able to pay.
Hey, listeners, tune in next week as we continue this great episode with Anna Kelly. You're not going to want to miss it. See you next week.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I appreciate you being a loyal listener. Say, I would love to have you go on to our Facebook page and subscribe. Give us a thumbs up. Go on to iTunes or wherever you listen and give us a rating and review. Don't forget to subscribe. But your rating and review just helps us push this out to more and more people and continue to grow our audience and hopefully positively affect a ton of people out there that really need this and want this. So the other thing I've got for you is a free ebook on my website. So go on to venturedproperties.com, venturedproperties.com, and download our free ebook on real estate and on syndication. And I've got some data points in there, some really good stuff for you. So I'd love to have you take a look at that. It's free. I'm not expecting anything from it. And also, look, if you want some help in multifamily, want some help learning, growing, getting your business off the ground, I would love to talk to you about what it would look like to work with me potentially and see if that's a good fit. So you can go to coachwithdex.com and check that out, and we can definitely have a call. Thanks a lot for listening. You make it a fantastic rest of the day. I'll catch you on the next episode.